In session. Good afternoon, everyone. It is February 10, 2015. It's 3:30. This is the Senate Education Committee. We have a full slate of senators on the committee today. We have Senator Gardner, Senator Huggins, Senator Giesel, Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. We're going to hear a presentation today. We're going to hear a presentation from the Department of Education on the school rating system. This is the Alaska School Performance Index. Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It's once again by the Department of Education. There are a number of department folks here that will come up and present, and then we will have opportunities to ask the questions. Commissioner, do you mind if we ask questions during the actual slide presentation itself? Okay, so committee members, if you wish to ask questions during the process, just let us know. So, Commissioner, if you can come up, or whoever's going to help with the presentation, if you can identify yourself for the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. For the record, my name is Mike Hanna. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Neurodevelopment.
And Susan McCauley, the Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education.
Senator, at the request of this committee, we've been asked to review some specific federal programs and our waiver from some of those. We covered 2 weeks ago extensively the federal programs, largely Title I, but all of those title programs that fall within the Department of Education. And I wanted to start this presentation. The first couple slides might be different than what's in your packet, but just the first couple. They're just introductory slides. Because if our conversation starts with federal programs, there might be a misconception that we as a department are a federal entity or we're driven by federal programs. So I wanted to spend just a minute giving you the context of the drivers of education in Alaska, the drivers of our work at the Department of Education in Alaska. So the Alaska Constitution, I know you've heard it, it drives our work. It states that we have a responsibility to establish and maintain a system of public education. Alaska statute speaks to our responsibility to ensure that students are successful in their school and work. And we do that through four key functions. That is to fund our schools. And I say we, I mean, I'm talking about us as a state, the legislative branch and the department, to fund our schools, to provide oversight and support of our schools, to set standards, and then to assess our standards towards proficiency on those. And in a very simple way, we do that through legislative funding right now to the tune of about $1.5 billion in state funds to provide all of these services for our schools and our students. This slide simply adds the portion that we incorporate when we partner with the federal government to provide additional services and supplement the work that we do to expand opportunities and expand services to our students. You remember them from last time. We talked about students with disabilities, federal programs that help students in poverty, struggling students, homeless students, students that are English language learners, all of those programs that come into the state. Some have clearly academic focus, and some focus on the needs of our children so that we can meet their academic needs. Overall, we get about $232 million in federal funds compared to the $1.5 billion that the state contributes. Of that, there is a required, when we look at all those programs together, there's required about 1.4% state match for federal dollars. It's a pretty good return on investment, especially when we look at the needs that we're meeting of our kids. Of those funds, we're also allowed to keep 2-3%. We're authorized to do that for administrative purposes. So some of the things you'll see in tonight's presentation speak to personnel that we have that at least part of their position is federally funded. That is to engage these programs and to get the money out the door and the services out the door to our students. The Department of Education does not benefit from federal funding. The beneficiaries are the students in our state. We do have employees that are paid with that to make sure that our students get that. So I wanted to just start with that to give you the context that what we've been talking about is that small outer circle that represents about 15% of the funding in our budget that does reflect federal funding. It doesn't drive our work. It doesn't drive how we organize our department or the infrastructure. It simply supplements the work that we do to allow us to better meet the needs of our kids.
Commissioner, yeah. I have to interject. I do believe, in all honesty, there's a lot of people that don't necessarily agree that the federal government is not the tail that wags the dog. I'm just saying I've had too many folks, both in the school level, the district level, legislative level, believe that the question is, if that's the case, then we can basically do what we want, that this is a block grant and we can do what we want. But you look at what's happening in other states with lawsuits to try and get out of, quote, Common Core. You look at other states almost daily. Chicago last week, a week and a half ago, was threatened with being fined by the U.S. Department of Education because they were not, I think it was, assessing at a certain time. There were others in Texas that are trying to get a waiver on the evaluation concept that the federal grants had brought with it. They were being threatened with being fined. I hear what you're saying, but there's just too much information out there that seems to indicate that the federal government is taking a very active role in state education right down to the local level. So when you say there's a misconception, I think there's differing opinions. And I think those opinions, a lot of them are rooted in fact and not just just imagination. There's stuff constantly in the news. I could go right now on the iPhone and probably pull off 6-7 different articles happening all over the country just today. And so something is not right. Something is not right because there is a growing and there is a large proportion of folks. I'm not speaking for folks here in the committee. They can speak for themselves. But something is not right in which a lot of Americans believe that D.C. is has more of a hand in education than we'd like to think. And anyway, I just when you said it was a misperception, I think it was a perception. And I think it could be argued that if that's the case, we should test our relationship potentially with the federal government and do what we want. But then when I go down that road and I have those conversations with people, people say, well, look, you don't want to do that. We're going to lose the funding, or this will happen, or you'll be fined. So anyway, I need to interject a different a view. And so I'm not totally convinced that the federal government does not have a larger role than we would like it to have. I think it has a large role. I think it's, from my perspective, I think it is the tail that wags the dog. But anyway, I want to let you continue your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. And my comments spoke specifically to our department's role. And I can speak to the work that we do. And there can be perceptions about the work that we do, but I can speak to what drives our efforts. And what I would actually suggest is that we spend some time doing a similar presentation on the work that we do with GF, the work that we do to support and empower our school districts, the trainings that we do. We come alongside them to help with their budgets and all those types of things that aren't driven by federal money. So without belaboring that any further, I will go ahead and turn this over to Dr. McCauley to walk through our kind of a review and then a little bit more deep into Elementary and Secondary Education Act and the comparisons between that, those requirements, and the waiver that we got from some of those requirements.
Thank you. Doctor?
Thank you. Just as a review and a way of introducing more detailed content, this information was presented when we last presented, specifically with a review of the ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act federal programs, which you see listed there on the bottom of the slide. Again, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, as we typically refer to it, was initially passed in 1965. Its purpose is to provide supplementary funding for elementary and secondary education with an emphasis of fair and equal opportunities for students. The most recent reauthorization, as we talked about last time, was in 2001 as the No Child Left Behind Act, and that is still the current version of the SEA. The title programs, are listed on the bottom of the slide there, with specific focus on groups of students who may not have equal access to education due to variables at work in their lives, being homeless, living in poverty, being English language learners, and so on. I want to talk about No Child Left Behind and compare what it is and to what it is with a waiver. As you know, Alaska has a waiver from some elements of No Child Left Behind, and I'm going to walk through a compare and contrast of how those two entities work together. Under No Child Left Behind, the accountability model was one of adequate yearly progress, AYP, and the concept there was that when that was implemented, the objective was that 100% of students would be proficient by the year 2014. And each year, incrementally then, the expectations for proficiency in reading, writing, and math increased. They were standardized for every school and every district. Calling it a one-size-fits-all, in my opinion, is an accurate description. There was no consideration for where a school began. In terms of performance, there was a static expectation that all schools, all districts, were expected to meet. The corollary there is that with our waiver, we were able to design an Alaska-specific performance system, the Alaska School Performance Index, ASPE, which after we are finished with this slide, I will walk you through at a high level the metrics of that system. So that has been in place, that metric has been in place now. This is our second school year of being able to utilize ASPE, the Alaska School Performance Index, rather than AYP as the mechanism by which we rate schools, the metrics by which they are held accountable for student achievement. Additionally, the No Child Left Behind, going to number two, had in place AMOs, Annual Measurable Objectives. Again, I actually just touched on some of this. Those were targets for the percentage of students that were expected to be proficient each year, and they were standardized for every school and every district. We, part of the waiver, did include our setting AMOs, annual measurable objective targets, but we were able to set those school by school based on an expectation that over a six-year period of time, schools reduce by half the percent of non-proficient students. So just say that again. Based on where they started on a baseline year, that they reduce by half the percent of non-proficient students. And those AMO targets are specific to each school in the state of Alaska. They are not going to be the same in Shishmaref as they are at Cottonwood Creek and Matsu. They were based on their initial baseline data. Number three, under No Child Left Behind, there was increasingly very little differentiation in this school accountability system since no school would make AYP. Again, in order to make AYP, it was a pass-fail model where a school had to meet AYP, meaning meet the target expected for students proficient in reading, writing, and math, not just in school as a whole, but in every individual subgroup across the three content areas. And if a school didn't make it in one area, maybe students with disabilities or English language learners, then they did not meet AYP, period. So what happened over time as those that trajectory increased, as the targets increased, more and more schools did not meet AYP. And it ended up being that there was very little differentiation in terms of how many schools are making AYP. The vast majority of schools were not, and certainly were on a path to not, make AYP.
Doctor, mm-hmm. So what?
Senator Dunleavy, the so what, I think,
who,
is...
Who cares?
I think, Senator Dunleavy, I think that parents care. I think that educators care when their schools are rated as failing schools. I think that when targets are set that are unachievable, I think that resonates across the system in terms of lack of trust, in terms of lack of feeling that they can really do something to impact those data and those results. I think that schools and districts care when they have to do school improvement plans to address all of the areas in which they're not making AYP. I think districts care when their Title I funding has some restrictions in terms of what has to happen.
So the federal aspect we were talking about earlier kicks in.
As does what happens with the waiver that we were able to get flexibility from some of those elements, which Senator Dunleavy, the greater differentiation in terms of our having implemented the star rating system is painting a much different picture in terms of how schools are doing. We talk about, for our most recent rating, 75 five-star schools, 198 four-star schools, 149 three-star schools, 52 two-star schools, and 27 one-star schools. That's, in my opinion, a very different picture than 98 or 100% of our schools did not meet AYP. What that enables us to do as we endeavor to support schools and improvement efforts is be more deliberate, more focused, more informed about truly how schools are doing with a system that differentiates very differently than AYP did as it got closer and closer to that 2014 date.
Senator.
Thank you. And so do I understand correctly what you're getting at is if I have a child at, say, one school and it's a high-need school, the kids don't experience a lot of academic success, and it's an AYP, fail to meet AYP, you may have another school that also failed to meet AYP, but they have a lot of AP classes, a lot of successes among the students, but it's also failed to meet and the standard, and you can't, as a parent deciding what you want to do, you can't tell any difference between the two. It's either they meet it or they don't meet it.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's correct.
Okay.
The label, the rating under the AYP system would have been in both of those circumstances, did not meet AYP.
And that's it?
That's it.
They meet it, they didn't meet it.
That's it.
It's on off. Thank you.
Senator.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. McCauley, I think you said 27 schools were one-star for which year?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that is for this past year, the 2013-14 school year.
Yeah. So I guess could you just give me a 30-second burst on what the common traits of those 27 schools are, what their profile looks like, how many students, I mean, all the things that is important to education that are indicators, the commonality of those schools.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I can do that briefly now, and then I think that as we go through the ASPE metric, that will become much clearer in terms of how the overall star rating is generated. But in general terms, it is attributable to still a part of the metric, and you'll see specifically how much, is about what percentage of students are proficient on state-mandated assessments, but also how are those students growing from one year to the next. And so,
excuse
please.
Me. No, I understand that part, but I'm talking about the commonality of them. I mean, that's obvious that they aren't doing very well in the achievement piece, but they must have a certain size element. There's some commonality of the traits of the school. We know that they do very well because they're one-star. What's the commonality of the traits of them? What do they look like?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, first and foremost, and obviously, would be low student achievement. When we look beyond that, There are some commonalities and there are some differences. In some cases, in some of our one-star schools, we see large turnover of staff and leadership in those schools. In some, we see less. Some of our one-star schools are rural, some are urban.
Any size differential?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there are. And I don't have the list in front of me, but there are.
At some point in time, I'd just be interested to see what it looks like, because there has to be some commonality and some outliers. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator?
Just to follow up, do they tend to be in low-income neighborhoods?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, without having the list in front of me, I'm hesitant to generalize without having the exact list of schools in front of me.
Please continue.
So number four, the No Child Left Behind metric, the AYP metric, was based solely on proficiency. And I think I've given this example several times, but I'll give it again. The target was a score of 300, at least on our statewide assessments, a score of 300. So if a student went from a score of 298 to 301, that was recognized by the AYP model because they got over the 300 mark. If a student went from 167 to 299, there was no recognition because they did not get over the proficiency hump, so to speak. So there was no recognition in the metric of growth of students unless that growth moved them from below proficient to above proficient. The ASPE metric, as you'll see, is a combination of emphasis on both proficiency, whether or not students are demonstrating a proficient attainment of knowledge and skills, as well as growth. And growth is actually the larger part of the metric now. It's 40% of the metric, as compared to 0% of the metric before. And that, as I've spoken with educators across the state, teachers in particular, makes much more sense to them. The growth component recognizes growth across seven levels, from relatively low achievement to very high achievement. And credit is given, so to speak, in the ASPE metric for moving a student from any one of those levels up to another level, whether or not that student is yet proficient, because growth, the idea, the thinking is, if continued, will lead toward proficiency. There is still, as you'll see, expectations regarding proficiency as well. Number five was that there was not a system for recognizing schools showing excellent growth. Schools that showed very, very high rates of proficiency were recognized, but through meeting AYP primarily, but there was no recognition for schools that may not have had very high rates of proficiency but were showing really impressive growth. The metric and the reward status, so to speak, of a school was not permitted for in the previous metrics. What was permitted for was, did they or did they not meet AYP? The new metrics and the new system has us recognizing reward schools in two categories: those that do have very high rates of proficiency and those that have very high rates of growth. And that too has been a point that educators across the state have felt is much more fair, makes much more sense. Number six, the AYP process before required the Department of Education to identify schools for school improvement, corrective action, or restructuring. So schools that did not meet AYP year after year, particularly if they were Title I schools, then had to implement various kinds of plans in order to address those deficiencies. We, through our waiver and our new school accountability system, no longer have to identify schools for improvement, corrective action, or restructuring. The No Child Left Behind would have had school improvement plans required for all schools, because if a school was not meeting AYP, a school improvement plan was required to address the area of deficiency. The new ASPE system number 7 has a differentiated school improvement plan structure, where 1 and 2 star schools have different requirements for their school improvement plans than 3-star schools, and 4 and 5-star schools only have to create a school improvement plan if they are not meeting an AMO, an annual measurable objective target, and only specifically for that area, not a broad comprehensive school improvement plan. So the requirements for school improvement plans under the new school accountability system actually vary quite a bit from 1-star schools to 5-star schools. Number 8, as I mentioned, No Child Left Behind increasingly had directing of Title I funds, specifically through what a required set aside for supplemental educational services to supplement the education of students in schools that were not meeting AYP. And under the waiver, there are no additional requirements in place for Title I funds, other than those that, of course, are already in place in terms of what I presented last time and how those funds are to be used. There, through No Child Left Behind, there was no funding structure based on school performance. Under our waiver, there are funds, they are a subcomponent, so to speak, of Title I funds that are provided to the lowest performing Title I schools. They're called, we call them 1003A funds, because that's the category in Title I. It is 1003A. And these are funds specifically to be used by 1 and 2 star schools that are Title I schools towards school improvement. So from a perspective of increased funding directed to the neediest schools in terms of student achievement, that is much more a component of our waiver than it was previously.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So in terms of being a Title I school, it's a 1 and a 2 star that makes a school be a Title I school?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, no. It is a Title I school is that by virtue of having a certain percentage of its students from living in poverty. What the connection between Title I status and star rating is that when a Title I school is a 1 or 2 star school, there are federal funds that can be allocated through the department to those schools for the purpose of school improvement.
Thank you. So I don't need this information right now, but at some point I'd be interested in knowing how many 1 and 2 star schools we have that are not also Title I schools. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Dr. McCauley, we had a short conversation previously about Mount Edgecombe, which I happen to be an admirer of. I've never been to the campus, but I've ridden lots of airplanes with Mount Edgecombe students, either going to school at the beginning of the year, but particularly over the holidays. So I'm not picking on Mount Edgecombe. I'm just trying to figure out where they fit in the performance profile, because the context of our last conversation about Edgecombe was, were we cherry-picking students from communities and degrading? But that's not my question. My question is, what star rating is Mount Edgecombe? You're the fourth.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yeah. It's a 4-star.
And what, is it a Title I school?
I actually don't. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Oh, you'll get back with us on that. why, what would you attribute that to? Why is that?
It's my
what? Title one? Less? Title one. Yeah, so getting to Senator Gardner's point about income, it's a factor, but it can be overcome, and I think we just saw an example about how you can overcome that. And I think we all should be proud of Mount Edgecombe. I know riding on an airplane with those guys, it's kind of exciting to watch them. They're from all over the place, and some are kind of grumbling about having to go back to school, but as you said, they're doing well because they're a four-star. So I rest my case, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
So taking a look at the ASPE metric.
Doctor, so we're leaving that.
Yeah.
The question I have is, and this is a guesstimate, how much time would you say the department spent time-wise, daily, on no child left behind issues, the issues in the left, the original no child left behind of 2001? I 5% of your day, 10%, 50%, 70%.
Are you talking about our overall staff?
Yeah.
The work of the department?
Mm-hmm.
My apologies, Senator Dunleavy. I'm probably not going to be able to give you a percentage, and I can explain from my personal perspective why. I don't tend to go about my work, nor do I advise my staff to go about their work from that perspective. I've been at the department for 2 years, and my consistent message to my staff of nearly 70 is that they are there to support districts and schools, period, and that they are to go about their work every day from a disposition of support.
Would you say that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I don't ask them to think about things that way. I don't ask them to put on their federal hat versus a state hat. I ask them to go about their work in a way that is supportive of districts and schools, whether that is assisting them with a compliance report for the use of Title I funds or getting on a plane and flying to a district, as three of my staff did 2 weeks ago, to help at an in-service. So I just don't go about my work that way, in a way that can provide an accurate answer.
Are the majority of the staff, are they general fund funded or are they federal funded? So out of every 10 staff at the department, what would you say the percentage of federal funded folks are versus general funds?
Through the chair, Senator, to the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Another document that you receive, I believe, is entitled Personal Services Position Funding Detail. That is specifically for the component of student and school achievement. Those are staff positions, and each position specifically is identified as being either funded through general funds or federal receipts or co-funded. And at the bottom of the third page, it indicates that 53.4% of those staff are funded through federal receipts, and the remainder are funded through general funds. So a little more than 50% of the staff there are general receipt funded.
I believe it's important to note that those are not all connected to No Child Left Behind, though. Those are connected to the programs we mentioned, our title programs, our child nutrition services programs. We have other title programs that are not tied to our No Child Left Behind.
Okay, so 53% plus these are folks funded by federal dollars. One would assume that at least half of their work is related to their federal dollars.
Chair Dunleavy, it's on a position by position basis, one can see the percent of work attributable to either federal work or non-federal work by virtue of the percent funded by either of those. I'm looking at, for example, 6 staff members down. An education specialist 2, where 17% of that individual's work is related to federal work, and 83% of that individual's work would be non-federal work, as evidenced by it being GF-funded. So that is how we go about looking at what funding mechanism is appropriate staff member by staff member, if that is directly the result of the work that they are doing.
Thanks.
So if we look at the ASPE metric, again, from a very high level, the metric for schools with students in grade K through 8 is that there are three elements of it. Attendance rate makes up 25% of the metric. Academic achievement, that is proficiency, makes up 35%, and school progress makes up 40%. And so
how do you deal with a homeschool correspondence program?
Chair Dunleavy, the metric for them is the same.
For attendance?
It is.
They take rural? I'm not trying to be obtuse. I just am a little familiar with homeschool correspondence programs, and they attend school outside of a building usually.
I know that, Chair Dunleavy, the metric is the same. I don't know what their mechanisms are for taking attendance, not taking attendance, how parents document that their students are in school, so to speak, learning on the days that they are learning.
Okay.
So the three components there, just to provide information about what those are, academic achievement is the average of the percent of students who are proficient or above in reading, writing, and math. School progress is the progress from the previous year's assessments, and attendance rate is the average attendance of all students.
And that's attendance rate again, not enrollment, attendance.
That's, Chair Dunleavy, that's correct.
Okay.
So when those various components, those three components, points are earned for each of those are calculated at the percentage of the ASPE metric attributable to each of those. For example, growth, as I mentioned, is 40% of the metric. A total amount of points is attained by a K-8 school, and that results in a correlating star rating according to the total number of ASPE points. And that is the metric there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator?
I have a question, and there may be a better time to answer it, but House Bill 278 included a provision that for low-performing schools, teachers would have an exemption from jury duty during the school year, and in terms of the regulations implementing that provision, is it a one-star, two-star, or where are we drawing the line for that?
Chair, Senator Gardner, that's all that 278 did. We had a provision in there before. It spoke to low-performing schools. Our regulation identifies low-performing as one- and two-star schools.
Thank you.
The metric for the Alaska School Performance Index for schools with students in grade 9 through 12 adds two components. It takes down the percent attributable to attendance rate and adds in graduation rate as 20% of the ASPE index, and then adds 10% for college and career-ready assessments, those being ACT, SAT, or WorkKeys.
Question. Graduation rate, is that still based upon four-year progression? Or can somebody be in high school for 6 years?
Chair Dunleavy, it's based on either a four-year cohort formula or a five-year cohort formula, and schools receive points based on whichever is higher. So there is a, if their four-year rate, four-year graduation rate earns them more points, then that is what is calculated as part of their ASPE metric. If their five-year graduation rate earns them more points, that is the rate that is used for the purpose of ASPE.
But if it's an alternative school or some other type of school and they wish to have a six-year high school, they're dinged for that?
Chair Dunleavy, they are, the expectation for either a 4 or 5 year rate is still there. However, we actually created a different metric that has been in place for the first time this year for alternative schools. And while we maintained an expectation regarding graduation rate, we reduced the amount of the ASPE metric that is attributable to that for alternative schools. And I didn't prepare to show you what that metric is, but the components of the ASPE metric for alternative schools are the same components, but they are in different percentages of emphasis. Growth, for example, for our alternative schools is at a greater percentage of the ASPE metric than for non-alternative schools. Proficiency is less, as is graduation rate, because of the nature of the students who come to those schools. Frequently come in very behind in credits. It's very difficult, in some cases likely impossible, for them to graduate on time, which would be 4 or 5 years depending on the metric. So it is an adjusted formula for alternative schools for the first time this school year.
So in state law, it allows for two extra grades. There is an AS 1400 that allows for that. If the school district decides to do that, they run into a problem with this, potentially. In other words, if they want to have six high school grades, because they're not finishing it, they may not be finishing at the time that they're supposed to be finishing at.
Chair Dunleavy, for the purposes of the expectations for graduation rate for ASPE, it would not recognize a six-year graduation rate. It would recognize either 4 or 5.
I would like to mention that we worked with our alternative schools extensively on when this was changed. They brought it forward and said, our schools aren't, with this metric, our schools are all looking 1 and 2 star schools, but yet we're doing great things. When it changed, we saw those better reflect the work that they were doing, and they were very appreciative of it. I think they liked the change that we put in place.
One last question. So in this mix, there's no piece of the pie, there's no percentage that takes into account, for lack of a better term, student or parent satisfaction with the school?
Chair Dunleavy, that's correct.
So if the parents are 100% satisfied, theoretically, with their school, and they love their school, and their kids love the school, it could have poor indicators in the categories that are laid out and be considered a one-star school. A one-star school could be loved by their parents and their kids. Theoretically.
Theoretically, Chair Dunleavy, that could happen.
Okay.
So, again, the way that it works for a 9-12 school is that school progress component is calculated, meaning how much progress was made from the previous year, percent of students proficient, attendance rate, graduation rate, and work keys ACT or SAT. Add those points up at the appropriate percentages of the overall metric, and a star rating is the result of that. And I believe that is the end of what we plan to present.
Questions? You all understand it now? Is there anyone online? No one online. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Or No one in the audience? No one online? Well, with that, let's take a one-minute recess. I've got to find my sheet. Back in session. Any questions from Senator Giesel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand that this STAR rating system's been in place for a couple years. Has it made a difference, and how did you measure that difference?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, one way that I measure the difference, and this is from an individual who came from the schools, who was a principal and a teacher, and felt that when our AYP scores came in, they were what they were because there was no way to change them. They just, you know, they didn't always reflect well, but we surely didn't feel empowered to change them. I see engagement on school board levels, superintendents levels, principals levels, and teacher levels. When they say, we were a three-star school, but we just needed two more points, and we could have, so here's what we're going to do. We barely made four stars. We got to work on, because they were suddenly empowered and recognized that it wasn't a pass-fail, but they had a system in place, and they were engaged with how to improve that and how to improve their student performance. I found that in and of itself to be very powerful. I've had superintendents call me and say, we are a high-performing school, and we're going to get one of the banners this year. Would you be willing to come out to an assembly? And these are Lake and Penn School District, Superintendent Mace out there. I've attended a couple of theirs, and they're just so excited. They make it a big, you know, like a state championship that we made. You know, we're a five-star school, and we're high-performing or high-progress. I see engagement in improvement that I didn't see before and I didn't experience before.
Senator Giesel and Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up. So what I was listening for is the difference that it made to students and parents. And I didn't hear that group mentioned, those groups mentioned.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I'm trying to picture conversations I've had with parents, but I know that we've had students that have been engaged, especially these particular ceremonies that I've taken part of, very excited, and they show a lot of pride in how their school is doing. Not just how they're doing as individuals, but the school that they are a part of, is they're engaged in that overall process. So I would like to extrapolate that and say that it translates to parents as well, but my conversations were more with students. So I don't have information for you specifically on parents.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
The College and Career Ready indicator, that's entirely based on scores that students receive on those three tests, work keys, HD, SAT. Does that have nothing to do with dual credit classes? Does that enter into that at all? How the students, the fact that the students are taking dual credit classes, just entirely based on their scores?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's correct. And that recently changed. It used to be number of students participating in work keys. And then with the passage of HB 278, this metric quickly, you know, we put out a new regulation to reflect scores on the three approved assessments. But it is just a matter of scores on those.
here?
Thank you, and I think the value in that and the reason that it's there, in part at least, is because we have our own test scores and our own assessments, but this is sort of a third party that's ranking and evaluating all students across the country on the same metric and the same testing.
Through the Chair, Senator Gardner, our goal is to ensure that our students are successful in their work and school. That's one indicator. Mm-hmm. The work keys indicates a readiness for a particular career. And ACT, SAT, whether we like it or not, is kind of the language that our universities and our colleges use to deem whether students are ready for that.
So, again, we would be doing this ASPE work regardless of our association with federal government, federal funds. We would have done this anyway. This was being planned, and this would have happened. I'm asking.
Chair Dunleavy, if we had the choice to create our own accountability system totally on our own, this is what we would create. But we were incentivized to get out from under AYP, out from under some of those components of No Child Left Behind, to create our own. So this is a result of additional flexibility that we've been given from No Child Left Behind due to our waiver. So it is connected to our waiver.
And I'm wrestling with this issue that I think the first slide or two that you were speaking to, Commissioner, I think the purpose of that was to either remind or emphasize that we are a state and we run our own system. But the conversations I'm having more and more with folks seem to indicate that it always ties back to the grants and the federal government. And so that's what I'm trying to get my handle on around. Is it the tail that wags the dog? Is it the federal government that's controlling the larger proportion of funding and local control and state control? Or then I'm getting other messages that, no, we'd be doing this anyway. It's opportunistic. In other words, we got the grants at the same time and we would be going in this direction anyway. So it's not just me. I'm just letting you know there's a lot of folks, not just in this state, but across the country that are going through the same questioning process, who's in charge of the educational programs of the states. And I'm hearing you say that the state is, but then the conversations I'm having with principals and teachers and superintendents and board members almost exclusively goes back to, we have to. We have to do this. We have to. Well, why do you have to? Well, the grants, the federal government, the State Department says we have to. We have to. We have to. And this is very, very subjective, but any idea what you would attribute that to? Because I don't see it in most other aspects of state government, that there's this confusion, disconnect, I don't know how to word it, that this is our program, we got local control, but then when you talk to folks, they're doing their work to meet the guidelines of the grant. Can you help me out?
I can. We do have state mandates. We do have accountability measures, as are expected with the funds that we provide. I will say that even if we didn't have a No Child Left Behind, and even if we didn't have a waiver, we would still be measuring our schools and providing support for those schools that were low performing. We have a responsibility to do so constitutionally, and that's part of the maintaining our system of public education. And that is empowering and supporting supporting our districts, especially when they're struggling. So we would do that anyway. Does it look like this because we have a waiver from No Child Left Behind? Probably. Would it look differently? It might. But we would still do it. The idea that we're doing it because we feel like we have to. When I was a teacher, I was pretty sure that the sources of all my ills came from the administration in the Anchorage School District. Until I became a principal, and I was one of them, and I was confident that the sources of all my troubles were the state. I find myself now as commissioner that must not be the state, it has to be, you know, the federal government.
Legislature.
Oh, the legislature, I was going to skip over that. But it's partially because I'm doing things because I'm responsible and I need to do them. I don't fully have an understanding as a teacher of, you know, where these mandates are coming from. Some of these, our responsibility to provide assessments, our responsibility to assess our students on proficiency, you know, those are statutory. And I think those are important. I think we need that data to understand how our kids are doing and how we're doing with our kids. Some of it, is it mandated by, you know, federally? Yes. We're talking here about school accountability and the 1 through 5 stars. That's not our focus, you know, for 12 months of the year. It's not. It's a small focus that we do because we think it's valuable. It helps us identify where resources need to go, and because there are some requirements by the federal government that we do it. But it doesn't drive the core part of the work that we do. I don't wake up every day saying, you know, thinking about school accountability system.
Any additional questions? Comments? Thank you. And with that, we're going to have our next meeting on Thursday. We're going to be hearing SB 31, which is a sexual abuse assault prevention program bill. And with that, we are adjourned.